work session to order. This is a work session. The City Council has asked for a work session with city staff regarding infrastructure needs in Columbia, particularly in South Columbia. There's been a lot of publicity about recommendations for infrastructure improvements on the south part of Columbia, which involve transmission lines. I kind of come from a background where I think it's important to define problems before we get into a lot of alternatives to fix the problems. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to have a presentation from the staff at the Water and Light Department. They're going to give us an overview of what they see as our infrastructure situation throughout town, particularly south of town. They're going to offer some of their insights as to which way they want us to go. Let me point out that this is an informational meeting. It's designed for the council to interact with our staff. It's a public meeting. There will not be a public hearing. There will not be an opportunity for public comment tonight. I will assure you that once we define the problem, once we start discussing solutions to the problem, there will be multiple public hearings. But again, tonight is informational. So I'll turn the microphone over to the city manager, and he can initiate the discussion.
Thank you, Mayor. Tonight's meeting is a informational meeting. We started talking about this subject, and we'll go through the entire time frame. A number of years ago, we had a work session with the council, and then ultimately an ordinance was approved back in March to purchase some property for a substation. I would apologize in advance in that we should have had this meeting before we had the interested parties meetings that were held. We did not bring the council up to speed, and we should have had probably several discussions with the council before we began meeting with folks. Nevertheless, what we're trying to do is to start over today, to make the case as to why we need to do something and the time frames at which we need to do it. I want to make it absolutely clear that this is not something we need to do tomorrow. But I think we need to move judiciously to make decisions as a community on what we need to do. I got an email today from the Board of Realtors that indicated that there were some house transactions that were being delayed until this got decided. So it's not something we can put off and put off and put off. It's something we need to address, as I said, judiciously, but not in haste. With that, I'm going to ask our Water and Light Director, Tad Johnson, to make a presentation as to what's being proposed and why. Tad?
Okay, thanks. I want to say thank you for allowing us the opportunity to come in and make this presentation. I kind of wanted to start by introducing the folks that are on our side of the house over here. I'm Tad Johnson, the Water and Light Director. To my left here is Ryan Williams. He is the Assistant Water and Light Director. He's been intimately involved with the planning of this project for quite some time. Also over here to the left is Sega Engineering Consultants. There's John Clayton and Stephen Roddick from Sega Engineering. They are the consultants that we've used in the line route, in the route selection portion of this thing, and also some of the substation selection pieces of this project too. So I want to make sure you knew those folks on our side of the house. I believe they will all have a chance to talk this evening and will be answering questions as you have them. I want to make sure you knew that the purpose of this this project is to review our new substation selection and our new routes for the transmission project that we've talked about. First thing I want to do is kind of go over a little bit of history on where we've been with this project so far. This project really started out probably in around 2005, is when we started having some issues that needed to be addressed on the import capabilities, specifically on the south side of our system. Back in that timeframe, we had a number of negotiations with Associated Electric with some import restrictions that we were having, specifically as they pertain to the grindstone substation that we had on there. That resulted in a number of meetings, and out of that process, we had one 161 line that was tied in and out of the grindstone substation at that time. That project went live, or we energized that line right around the summer of 2007 was when that grindstone line was energized. Basically, if you have a map up there, and we will have some maps of that that we'll put on the screen here in a minute, but we took a 161 line out of the Associated system, and it does run up our east side. We tied it in and out of the grindstone substation to address an import problem that we had in our south side. Like I said, that happened in 2007 on that thing. Another historical note in here is in 2008, as a function of our IRP, one of the things that was specifically mentioned in there is that we were going to need to pursue transmission projects to improve the import capabilities on our system. That was also known, and that was also studied as part of our IRP process in 2008. That's kind of the history that's leading us up to where we are right now in this project. And these are the planning processes that I've kind of identified here that are leading up to where we are this evening. What I want to do is I want to start with kind of an overview of the project, of where we are with this, and kind of a description of our system and why we need these from a high-level perspective. And then Ryan's going to go into the more detailed perspective of our system and the individual modeling and the needs and some of the reasons why specifically on the certain sites we need to have expansion or new lines tied to them. And then after that, SEGA, the folks over here too, are the ones that have been contracted to work on the line routing issues and some of the site selection issues, and they have a portion that they have to cover that area. So as I go through this thing, those were kind of the three areas that I kind of broke this presentation up into, and we'll go through them. First, I wanted to make sure that you guys understood that the City of Columbia is really what's called a transmission-dependent utility. In that I mean a majority of our power is truly imported to our system. We do have unit participation contracts outside of our system, and we do have generation inside our system, but the majority of the generation inside our system is peaking generation. This is generation that's used for a little bit for load following or regulation services, but a majority of it is peaking, so it does not run as what you call baseload units for our system. So I want to make sure you understood how dependent, I guess, our system is on imports. Energy imports into our system is a very important piece of our electrical puzzle that we have. One thing that I want to make sure you know is that we kind of have our system broke into a transmission element and kind of a sub-transmission element. That's kind of termed a dual transformation system. What we do is we will bring energy in through our import characteristics on above 100 kV. In this case, we have 161 kV lines to bring it in. And then we will transform it down to a 69 kV system. The 69 kV system basically runs the energy around our ring to the different substations in town. And then once it's at the substation where the load is needed, then it will transfer it down one more time to distribution voltages that get distributed on the system. So just that's really all this slide here is just indicating that this is kind of the makeup of how energy gets to the load in our community. We go through what's called a dual transformation system. And the transmission substations are the Volstead, the Grindstone, the Pershey, the McBain, and the Rebel Hill. Those are our transmission level substations. Then you also go down to the sub-transmission stations, which is our 69 stations. That's Volstead, Grindstone, Harmony Branch, Hingston Creek, the power plant, and Pershey Creek. And the next one has a slide. They'll have those on there. This is a picture of our system, and this is kind of the transmission overview of what our system is configured like. If you look at that, you can see on the east side of our system is our primary 161 line that runs up and down the east side of our system. This transverses from the Volstead substation, it runs through the Rebel Hill substation, and it goes in and out of the Grindstone substation, which we just talked about, and the last circle down there is an Associated Electric substation called Boone. That's the transmission system to our east side. We have two more pieces of transmission system out there. We have the Pershing Creek tap. If you can see to our west side of our system, we have one transmission line that's headed off of the Pershing Creek substation out there. That is basically a tap off of the Ameren transmission system that comes through our system. And like I said, that is just a tap. So you have one line feeding the sub-transmission system on the west side of our system at that point. We also have one piece of transmission that's off to our south, and that's the McBain line you'll see out there. There's a black line headed off of the McBain substation out there. That is a piece of 161 line that goes between a associated substation and an Ameren substation. And the purpose for that was when we transferred our Sikeston power over to an Ameren contract, we negotiated to put that line in there so that we could take delivery of our Sikeston power through Ameren transmission. In addition, obviously, it's in a position that is in the general direction where our load is growing on our system, too. Excuse me. I think that's it for that. I also talked about the sub-transmission system. This is an overview of our sub-transmission. Like I said, our sub-transmission system is a 69 kV ring. In this picture, this is the red loop that goes around our system. Excuse me. Primary purpose of the sub-transmission system is to distribute the transmission energy that's delivered on our system in a sub-transmission level to the individual substations. And as you can see from the red ring around there, it kind of went around what was kind of an incorporated boundary on our system probably when this thing was put in. So it kind of went around the Columbia's service territory at that time. And as you can tell, there's probably one specific direction that we've primarily grown over what was our original sub-transmission boundary, and that's to the south of our system and a little bit to the southwest of our system on this one. Okay. One thing that I wanted to make sure that you saw here was this is a combination of map. It shows our electric service territory, and this, I believe, is covered in red. The red line is our electric service territory, and the blue line is our city limits. One thing of note here to point out is that our electric service territory actually extends beyond our city boundaries, primarily to the south and to the southwest. So we have a potential for more load growth beyond our current existing city boundaries in those directions on our system right now. Okay. Kind of back up to the transmission system, and like I said, this is kind of an overview of where we are. We are a transmission owner and a transmission operator under the Federal Energy Reliability Council. This is a regulatory agency that governs transmissions. As probably most people know, transmission has been a very increasing popularity and subjects amongst the regulatory circles. As the loads have grown and the interest has gone to getting outside resources for renewables, the transmission system is what has had to been looked at recently on our system to make sure that the energy can be transmitted from the power resources to the loads. So FERC and NERC, which is the National Electric Reliability Council, have come up with rules and regulations that we are governed by those. And to summarize a couple of them, what we have here is the occurrence of any single transmission outage cannot cause any overloads on other elements of the transmission system. This includes other systems' elements, not just our own. I mean, if we can't have a problem on our system and overload anything on Ameren's system, we can't overload anything on associated system. We have to be responsible for the integrity of our system and make sure we don't cause other people problems with our activity. The other thing we have is the occurrence of any two transmission outages cannot cause a cascading outages on the system. Cascading means generally that if you overload one element, it will cause another element to be overloaded, and pretty soon you'll be taking out large sections of load because you don't have a control point that this thing is going to disconnect at. Or you'll trip out two or three things at a time. So the initial event of tripping caused a lot larger area to trip out. So those are the kind of the two standards that we have as they apply to our system. If we go to the next one. Taking these two standards and kind of applying them to our transmission area that you see, you can see that while we have a 161 line that runs up and down the east side of our system and it's fairly connected with the outside world, we have the tap that comes into our Pershing substation. What you can see from this is if we lose that one line on the Pershing Creek substation, which is our 161 line headed out of the west side of town, we've isolated the entire west side of our sub-transmission loop without any transmission sources to it. So that's where some of our problems are coming into as we grow, as we're overloading our 69, or we're putting a lot more load on our 69 loop. And when we remove a transmission link to that 69 grid, it has to come from the other side of the grid. One of the things that you can see that from a, just a engineering perspective that seems to make sense is we have a line from McBain down there, and it would make sense from a just looking at it point of view is if we could convert the tap at Pershing Creek to a transmission line and connect it up to McBain, we would have a redundant feed, a redundant transmission feed to the west side of our system. So that's one of the things that we need to try to find a way to get done is get some redundancy from a transmission perspective to the west side of our system. Back to the standards on the 69 kV system. It's very similar to what we have from the federal perspective on the transmission side. Once again, we cannot have a single outage overload any other element of our system out there, and we cannot have a double occurrence of outage causing a larger spread outage or a cascading outage of our system. If we go back and take a look at the same slide as it applies to the 69 system here, you can see that while we have the ring around there for the 69 loop, if we pull sources out of that thing, the only thing that we can do is to try to somehow add 69 capacity to on our ring. One way of doing that is we can either increase problem sections of our 69 ring by adding capacity to it, or we can add 69 what they call like cross ties. In this case, one of the things that would look like would solve the problem is we could take a 69 line from the power plant to the Harmony Branch substation, which would kind of bisect our ring and provide an alternate path to get to the other side of the ring rather than having to go through the ring path. This would be a redundant feed to that side of the system. This would be one of the things that we could do to try to mitigate some of the issues. And like I said, when I'm going through these things, I'm just trying to get you an overview of the problems as they exist to us, and Ryan will kind of go through some of the solutions that we've come up with out there. The last thing we have is our substations. One thing I want to make sure you know is that we expect that when we have a maintenance issue at a substation, when we have a problem with the feeder circuit, when we have something go, because this is equipment that gets maintenance, it's moving equipment, it does have problems. Everything is going to have to be planned for the fact when it voluntarily needs to go out of service for maintenance or when it goes out of service because of an operation or a fault on the system. Our intention is to still be able to feed load from the substations. And here are some guidelines that we kind of have put into effect, and these are really good utility practices on how you design your substations that you so you can continue to feed load. And it's kind of the same things we looked on some of our transmission issues. Excuse me. The first one is the occurrence of any single transformer outage. We do not want it to cause an overload on the remaining elements in the transmission in the substation. So we don't want, if we lose one transformer in the substation, we don't want it to overload the other transformers in the substation, because we're going to have to start dropping load to mitigate that issue. What this turns out to be is if you have two transformers in a substation, you can only load it up to 50% from a planning capacity and still withstand the outage of any one of the transformers, which makes sense. Same thing if you have three transformers. You can load it up to about 66% of what the rated capacity of the whole thing and of the whole substation is and still withstand a single outage of a transformer in those banks. And like I said, these things need to happen not only because transformers can trip for a number of different reasons, they also, we have to take these out for maintenance issues on somewhat of a regular basis to make sure that they operate the way they're supposed to. And another thing that we like to do from a substation reliability perspective is it's a good idea to try to minimize the length of the feeder circuits that come out of the substations. This has two beneficial effects. One is it reduces the losses that are used to take us to serve the load. Anytime you minimize your line, you don't spend as much energy just getting the electricity to the house, and anytime you have a longer line, then your risk for outage due to trees or traffic accidents or anything is reduced for all the people on that loop. Looking at our map here once again, and you will see this map a few times tonight, one of the things that we can do to address these type of issues as far as substation loading is we can add transformers to some of our existing substations. In this case, the substations, as you can see, that are incurring the most problem for us because of the loading issues are Pershing Creek, the Hinkson Creek and the Grindstone substations. Those are the ones that were having the most amount of loading increase, and those are the ones that are going to have to be addressed from a loading on the substation perspective. The other thing you can do is add a substation in where the service territory is growing to, and that addresses the issues with loading on this on the old substations, and also addresses the issues of trying to keep your feeder lengths down for losses and reliability purposes. Like I said, this is really just an overview. I'll just kind of go over the overview summary here. The issues that we're trying to get solved with our system here is we need a redundant 161 kV transmission source to the west side of our system so we can convert the Pershey tap to a transmission line, and it going to McBain seems to make the most amount of sense for us, at least from this perspective. The other thing we need to do is address some of the loading issues as they pertain to our sub-transmission ring on the 69 kV ring. We went over some of the options, and Ryan will go over those. And in addition to that, we need to add more capability to serve load. As the load grows and the load spreads out and it increases, generally you add more capability to serve load so you can keep your reliability up out of your substation feedings. So once again, you can either add capacity to the substations or you can add substations to serve the load. So with that, like I said, that was kind of the overview of what the Columbia system looks like, what the substations are, what the transmission issues are, what it looks like, and what the and where the substations are. So with that, I will turn it over to Ryan, and he will go over some of the modeling issues that we've been over and some of the solutions to these problems.
I'm going to kind of work backwards from where Tad left off. We're going to start by addressing the substation loading, and what I've got here is a graphic that shows our transformer loading at the three southern substations, our Grindstone substation, our Hinkson Creek substation, and our Perchy Creek substation. A couple things I'd like to point out here on this slide is I've got the numbers from 2007 and 2010. If you'll notice that the numbers in 2010 have grown slightly, so that our load is continuing to grow even during this recession that we're kind of going through. Another thing I'd like to point out is that at Grindstone, we have currently have three transformers, and the current loading is at 44.7%. At Hinkson Creek, we also have three transformers, and the current loading is at 68.6%. And at Perchy Creek, we currently have two transformers, and the current loading is at 64.4%. And what Tad had mentioned before is that where we have two transformers, loading over 50% is an issue for us. It doesn't allow us to be able to feed redundantly. If we were to have a problem with any one of those two transformers, obviously anything over the 50% of the load would have to be dropped. Basically, we would have to not be able to service approximately on the Perchy Creek substation, approximately 14% of that load would not be able to be served in an outage situation. And as you can also see at Hinkson Creek, we have crossed the 66% threshold, but just barely. Another thing I'd like to point out is in 2003, we had installed an additional third transformer at Grindstone, which is why the loading is down in the 44% range. We had done this to for perceived load that we had been told that was probably going to be developing in the industrial area on the west or the east side of town. That load has not yet been realized. In exploring these low growth options, Tad had mentioned that there was a couple things that we could do. We could add transformers or add a new substation. Adding additional transformers, physical space at both our Grindstone and Hinkson Creek is actually limited. There isn't room to put any more transformers at these two substations. So the only option that we would have to feed stuff in the southern portion of our service territory would be to add transformers at our Perchy Creek substation. And as Tad had mentioned, this would cause us to have to build extremely long distribution feeders. These distribution feeders would be more susceptible to outages due to weather storms and things of that nature. Plus, they would also be longer in length so that the losses, the line losses on these lines would be greater than having the loads closer to the substation itself. The other option would be to build a new substation where we could locate this new substation near the new load. If we did this, this would allow our distribution feeders to be shorter. These shorter feeders would be more reliable, less susceptible to storms and other outages, and also have less line losses. Kind of give you a little bit of project history on the substation. In 2007, we identified the need for possibly having a new substation. In 2008, we hired the consultant Sega to help us both with the site selection of the substation and with the line routes to this new substation. In January of 2009, we hosted a series of interested parties meetings with identified property owners we identified 10 original sites. At that meeting, none of the interested parties were willing to negotiate for a sale of that property. In the spring of 2009, an interested seller approached the city and offered land that was available. In the summer of 2009, another area owner requested that we investigate other properties in the southern portion of the service territory. In September of 2009, the Water and Light Advisory Board approved and recommended to City Council to adopt an ordinance to acquire the Peach Court site. This was done. The Peach Court site was determined to be the closest to the area of the load growth to keep the feeders in close proximity to where they were going to be needed. In January or February of 2010, we had a pre-council work session similar to this, describing the factors associated with building the new electric substation and three new electric 161 kV transmission lines. Then in March of 2010, the City Council approved Council Bill B-5410, adopting the ordinance to acquire the Peach Court site for the substation. And then finally in July, negotiations were finalized and we actually acquired the piece of property off of Peach Court. And for those of you who aren't familiar where Peach Court is just south of Nifong and west of Providence Road off of Peachtree Drive. So now that we've got this piece of property, I've decided that it would be a good thing to place the substation closest to where the load is going to be growing. We've now got to be able to supply power to this substation, and how are we going to accomplish that? We've got a couple of options. We can add to a 69 kV system or add it to our 161 kV system. One way to add it to our 69 kV system would be to bring a double circuit line from our current Hinkson Creek substation down to the new proposed substation. Or we could add the substation to our 161 kV system. And as you can see from here, the closest thing would be bring it from McBain to our Grindstone substation. Another one of the issues that Tad had highlighted was the fact that our 69 kV ring, and the portion that is weak, I've got highlighted here in bold red. It's the section that runs from the north from Bolstead down through Harmony Branch to the west, on to Perchy, through Hinkson, back to Grindstone in the east. And I'd like to point out that there are three substations basically off of this 69 kV ring: our Hinkson Creek substation, our Perchy Creek substation, and our Harmony Branch substation. The loading on these substations represents approximately 40% of the power that is being consumed by the city. To address the problems on the 69 kV system, we looked at three options basically. We could add generation, we could reconductor, or we could add additional 161 feed to Perchy Creek. Now, adding generation at Perchy Creek, we had looked at that, and there is a couple of problems that we ran into that. If fuel supply issues. The loads that we would need to offset would be in the 25 to 40 megawatt range, and the fuel that we would need, either diesel or we'd need to either start large amounts of diesel or build a pipeline down to this site to host the generation. And then we would have permitting issues that we would have to go through, air permitting and whatnot. It's a little bit different than handling at the power plant. The power plant's already currently permitted for that type of use, whereas building a new power production facility at Perchy Creek, we would have to go through the permitting process basically all over again. Another option we would have would be to reconductor the Grindstone to Bolstead through Perchy Creek line. And as Tad had mentioned, this line is our weak link, basically. In order to bolster it, we would have to build practically an entire new line along the 21 miles from Grindstone to Hinkson to Perchy to Harmony to Bolstead. And this is because it would require all new conductor. The conductor would be much larger than the current conductor that we have up there, which would require all new poles and all new hardware in order to be able to support it. The third option we looked at was to bring in 161 into Perchy Creek in order to bolster that side of the system. That could either be done, or the two closest substations would be from McBain or our current Grindstone substation. What we had come up with is a combined solution, a way to tackle both of those problems at the same time. And what we are proposed doing is supplying the new substation with a 161 kV feed and then continuing that on to our Approachy Creek substation. This would allow us to feed the load growth in the southern portion of our electric service territory and solve the problem of the loading on our 69 kV system. And from this, the three possible line segments are possible: a line segment from McBain to the new substation, a line segment from the new substation to Pergy Creek, or a line section from the new substation to our Grindstone substation. Kind of continuing with the project history, in June of 2010, SEGA presented staff with three or more alternate routes for each of the line sections. Again, in July, we had actually acquired the Peach Court site. In October of 2010, we hosted three open houses to introduce the transmission line project to the public and to gather comments from the public. We currently are receiving comments from the public at this time. We've gotten over 350 to date, and we currently receive about 5 to 10 a day through various forms, either mail, email, and our webpage. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Steve Rodick from SEGA, and he'll kind of describe the routing criteria that we had used to select these lines.
Whoa. I guess I just jumped one here, didn't I? When we were retained to do the routing study, we brainstormed with the city and came up with some general criteria that you see here. And those are, one is that it's preferred to put the new transmission lines on streets as opposed to backyards. The main reason for that is backyards are a bad way to make it hard to maintain a line, to get the heavy equipment in, to do the kind of things you need to do to transmission poles and wires is difficult to do in backyards. So the preference is streets over backyards. Similarly, it's preferred to not do cross-country if possible, largely because of access problems as well. Main roads are preferred over side streets. Side streets tend to be more residential, and we know that that is more of an impact to residents. And so we prefer main roads to side streets. Similar, commercial corridors are preferred over residential. I guess those two bullets are somewhat the same thing. But it seems like a high-voltage power line is more copacetic with a commercial corridor than a residential street. And the final bullet there is the most direct route is preferred. Obviously, the more direct the route, the shorter the line will be, making it less costly. And also, the fewer angles we can put in the line, the less it will cost to build the line. Angles can get very expensive. This is the map of the alternative routes that we identified for the Mill Creek to Perchy line. Mill Creek, get the mouse, is down here, and Perchy is up here. When we route a line, we want to come up with alternatives for evaluation. We really try to get at least three alternatives so that we have options. If we were to come up with one alternative, there might be a fatal flaw there, and we will have lost perhaps time and effort. And by doing the three options and presenting those to the public and to the city, we can then identify if there is a fatal flaw. We still got a couple options left to review and that sort of thing. So let's try to come up with at least three options. And each option has to be a buildable option. You know, we don't take the approach we want to put in a bad line, so we got something to throw away. We you know, really, it is hard to come up with a route through a community like Columbia, and this particular one was a difficult one to come up with three routes. And each of these routes, in my opinion, can be built. There might be reasons that people might have for not wanting a particular route compared to another, but from a technical standpoint, each of these lines can be built. The way this was done, I've been doing these routing studies for 35, almost 40 years, and I still don't know a better way to do it than what we did here. We took the maps at a larger scale, 500 feet to the inch. We put them on a wall in a conference room, and we put a pin at the Percy substation. We put a pin at the new substation. It was called Mill Creek, and we ran a string between the two. Well, the the preferred route would normally be a straight line between the two, but obviously you can't do that in a place like Columbia. So then, with that string anchored at one point and able to move to slide along the pin at the other point, we started, you know, putting in pin here, a pin here, a pin here, and so on, until we had a line route. We did that for the three alternative routes. Now, I will say we found more than just these three to start with, or we came with a grid of alternatives and then boiled it down to these three because these three seemed to be doable, whereas some of the others weren't as doable. So that is the route between Mill Creek and Perchy in the process. This is the route between Mill Creek and Grindstone. Now, the Grindstone substation, if I get the mouse to cooperate, is here, I believe. And so we have the three routes between here and, if I got the substation right, here. And then here is the line from Mill Creek to McBain. Here we found four alternatives, four similar to what we did on the other two, in that they, for the most part, follow streets or existing corridors. We do have some cross country here. This follows road here. And this one follows the state park. It will not be in state park land. It'll be to the edge of the park, so it'll be on private land. Even though that is cross-country, it is an opportunity for Columbia to own the right-of-way and thereby guarantee themselves ready access to maintain the line as necessary. So in this case, we have four routes. Now, you will notice that there is an orange route on some of these. This is we've labeled as possible alternatives. The purpose for that is so that say we identify this red route as a preferred route, and something makes it difficult to do this, well, maybe we can do this instead. So that just gives us an option, but those wouldn't be looked at until we identify, you know, the preferred route, and if we need to make an adjustment, we might take part of the red and part of the green to accomplish the final route. I believe that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve. I'm going to kind of go over some of the frequently asked questions that we've been receiving from the comments that we've gotten from the public. The first one is the funding of this project, and as of right now, the funding of this project has not been determined. Another commonly asked question is can these lines be buried? And the answer is yes, they can. It is a little bit more expensive. In working with our consultants, they suggest that an order of magnitude about five times more expensive to put the lines underground as it is to put them overhead. Yes.
I have a question on that. Could you go more into how that was determined? And particularly, I'm interested in, did you take in consideration that there'd be less easement to acquire, the cost of trimming over 20-year, 30-year period if it's underlined, all those other long-term costs?
At this point, we've only considered the construction costs were about five times. We have been talking with some other utilities that do have high-voltage KV lines underground, and there is additional maintenance required than what we currently have to do with our current underground lines that we don't do right now. These all have to be put in a concrete encased duct bank to prevent people from digging into them. Unfortunately, since the lines are so long, they do have to be spliced at certain locations. So at every place that we have a splice location, we have to put a vault in to give access to be able to get down there and do thermal imaging, what we hear on an annual basis, in order to make sure that the splices are still good from year to year. And as far as the easements, yes, they are smaller than would be required, but we have not looked at that at this point in time.
One point to make is
to make sure you heard, Ryan, this is really an installation cost. There's a lot of factors that are kind of involved in the whole life cycle or the whole complete project cost. We haven't really put the entire, for the term of the life of the project cost together. These are just installation costs to give you some idea of magnitude.
Ultimately, we'll need that information to make a good decision.
Yeah, another thing that's going to affect the cost on that is if you don't do the whole line, sometimes you can do sections of an underground, you go back above ground, but you still have the cost of making the transition in and out, and those are costs that you'll have to weigh against the cost of continuing it farther. So, I mean, there's quite a few variables that goes into really determining the ultimate cost or benefit from the change.
But other communities do that combination.
Yes, they do. Uh-huh. Yes, they do. They have certainly put lines in that go underground for ways, and they come back out. And I think I've heard of it going all the way up to about 230. It's about the voltage they vary with some regularity. But there is additional cost to it. I mean, there's no way around that.
Another one of the frequently asked questions is, what is EMF and what are the effects of EMF? EMF are electric and magnetic fields, which are generated by the flow of electrons through the lines. But they're also generated by many other common household items. I mean, light bulbs, hair dryers, cell phones, vacuum cleaners, anything that draws a high current that you would use creates both electric and magnetic fields that you could be exposed to, as well as the electric transmission lines. We found some information from the Environmental Protection Agency. Much of the research about power lines and potential health effects is currently inconclusive. Despite more than two decades of research to determine whether elevated EMF exposure, principally to magnetic fields, is related to an increased risk of childhood leukemia, there is still no definitive answer. And the general scientific consensus is that thus far, the evidence is weak and is not sufficient to establish a definitive cause-effect relationship.
Real quick, I just wanted to go over the kind of the overview of what the next steps are on this project, where we are right now. As you know, the open house was conducted in October, and we are still in the process of gathering comments from that. I'm sure we will be gathering comments for a little bit longer. After we kind of put those comments together, our intent is to review the comments and put a summary of what the comments are, and then revise the transmission line routings the way we see them to try to address any issues that came out of that can be addressed easily. Our intention after that is to really schedule additional public meetings that we have similar to the open house that we did already. I would assume or make a guess that these might be occurring sometime in the late winter, early spring time frame. I think we penciled a tentative date in there of February of 2011 that we might be able to be back out again for the open house informational type sessions. After we get the review comments from that one, then we'll put all that together and we'll make a presentation to our Water and Light Advisory Board to let them know kind of where we are and what the comments are and go over all the line routing options and the siting options and everything that goes along with that. As a result of that Water and Light Advisory Board meeting, our intention would be to be back in front of you in hopefully a work session type environment to kind of update you where we are, give you what's been given to us in the way of comments, both from the public and our advisory boards, and get that information back in front of you. And then at that time, we would hopefully come up with, based upon the input we get from you, from all these bodies, a more of a finalized transmission route that we've done from a staff level out there. Once we kind of finalize a staff recommended line route, then we would be back in front of our Water and Light Advisory Board with these recommendations. We would go back in front of the public as it was needed to be able to get this information back out in front of the public, and then we would go through kind of our final line routing selection process, which we would solicit a final recommendation out of the Water and Light Advisory Board, and then we would schedule public hearings in front of the council here for the decision to be made by the council. Certainly, Bill alluded to the fact that this project is at the beginning phases of this, and we have quite a bit of time to go through these steps out here, and we understand these things do take time.
Let me make a couple of points. I want to reserve the right to ask questions at the end of it. I'm going to turn it over to the Fifth Ward Council person after my comments. The need for this
needs to be better articulated. I mean, I'm like everybody out there. You know, when I hit the switch, I want the light to come on. The light comes on. I'm used to that. That's what I expect. I think you're telling us that we're not going to have the guarantee of electrical service if we don't upgrade. I think that's what you're telling us. But I don't know what that means. Does that mean we face an outage once every 5 years? Does that mean we face an outage once a week? You know, so I don't know what this problem means, and I would like to have that, as this process moves on, better articulated. Second point I want to make is I think this is a lesson that the council needs to take to heart. You made a recommendation the 1st of March for a public hearing on March 15th for this, at which time these line loops were present, and then staff put it on the consent agenda. And this, in fact, there was no public hearing. This was passed along with 30 other items on a consent agenda with, you know, the city clerk reading it in passing. And, you know, we've got to do better than that. We can't pass something that affects so many people so much just by slipping it into a consent agenda. We got to do better than that. And the last point I want to make before is that you've given us an engineering solution. I'm not sure we're looking for an engineering solution. We're looking for an engineering and a people solution too. And the solution that best suits this community may not be the best engineering solution. So I'm stepping back from the implied solution that there will be 361 kV power transmission lines. It may be right, but, you know, for me, and I think for many of the people that are engaged in this, that case has not yet been made. I'll have some more comments, but I want to turn it over to the Fifth Ward councilperson.
Thank you. I won't have any comments at the moment because I have a list of questions that I would like to have answered, and I think some of these you may have seen already, but I would just like to go through several of them. First of all, we kind of went through the beginning of this process with a kind of technical reason as to why we need to upgrade with FERC and NERC. Can you kind of go over exactly what those are so that the viewing public knows what FERC stands for and NERC stands for, and is this a federal mandate that's coming down upon us, or is this because we are subscribing to those standards we need to comply? So can you kind of go through that process?
Well, I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail because the situation can be a little complicated out there with FERC and NERC, but basically what happened is, as a result of some of the blackouts, and I think the most recent one was in 2003, if I remember right. But the whole regulatory agency actually started back in the 60s, but I said the most recent one was 2003. And because of what they considered to be not a coordinated response or a planning effort in the transmission and the operation of the transmission system, the federal government decided that they needed to be the regulators of it. Up until that point, NERC was in existence. This was the National Electric Reliability Council. And they were kind of an industry-based organization that was kind of a self-regulated branch, and they agreed to behave well and put everything that needed to be in place, and pretty much everybody abided by those rules with an occasional problem. The occasional problems is what FERC, which is our Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is what they came about, and through Congress action, they were mandated to be the regulators of the system. They said, you as the federal energy regulators are now going to regulate the transmission grid. So what they did was they put an application out for somebody to be able to be the electric reliability organization. NERC, who was the industry folks at that time, applied for that job and got that job, and they were converted from being an industry group to federal regulators. And it's just like any other area that's federally regulated these days, whether it's the banks or the stock market or anything else, it's a very similar program now where there's a lot of standards and requirements that they simply send federal regulators. This, right now, we're on a three-year cycle that they show up on our doorstep, and it's usually somewhere between 3 to 5 guys, sometimes more, for a week, and they're going through all the standards that they put on us. And these are finable standards these days. These are things that if we violate the standards, we can be financially fined for not complying with the rules that they put out there. Now, the purpose for this thing, just like I said, was to avoid blackouts. That's the purpose of this. And so all the rules are primarily aimed at transmission operations, or what they call the bulk electric system. So anything above 100 kV and some sub-transmission systems are going to be regulated under reliability standards, because the purpose is to not let the grid go down. That's the purpose behind these rules and regulations, is they want to govern what you do, how you do it, how you react, what rules you have in place, and you have to document that you're actually doing everything in place so that you can respond appropriately when an emergency happens and you don't respond inappropriately. You have to maintain the integrity of the grid. And as you can imagine, especially when they went through some of the open access issues that were going on in our industry, there was a lot of people that wanted to be able to buy and sell on a grid that was kind of tightly controlled. So when they opened up the grid for anybody to buy or anybody to sell on it, then you also had to regulate the fact that the people that are running the grid allow open access and they maintain a grid that people truly have access to, and they don't discriminate against people having access to your grid. And those are some of the reliability issues or some of the regulation issues that they're currently under, and currently some of these rules are aimed at. In addition to that, a lot of the renewable resources and a lot of the energy sources are now are located farther away from the load, like the wind energies and the biofuels and all this stuff. They're not necessarily located close to the load anymore, so there's a lot of stress on the transmission system, which the regulators understand and are trying to maintain to get from the generation to the load, and it's harder than it was previously.
And as we move forward on this project, the funding will be through rate increases, or how will we approach this, do you see, in the future as far as funding this project?
Whether funding for the project, I would see funding for the projects we have right now would probably go out for a bond issuance that would be reflected in rate increases for some time, just like we do with our other infrastructure type improvements that need to be funded by bond improvements.
I think you had said earlier we don't really have an estimate for the construction costs, whether it be above ground or below ground. But when you were talking to several of the other utilities, did you get any kind of indicator from them what their maintenance costs were for these? If they are underground, I think we could probably come up with a guesstimate on maintenance and costs for what we've recently installed here in our own community. But what were they saying when you spoke to them?
I'll let Ryan finish up with what I'm going to say, just to make sure that I'm being accurate here. I mean, he's going to have a little bit more detail than I'm going to have. But he had mentioned that some of the maintenance issues were a little bit different. Right now, when we go by a line, we infrared the lines. We basically stand outside and we have a camera that we can look for bad connections, and we can look for faults in the line, impending problems that could be coming, so we can fix them before they cause us a problem. And being up in the air, they're fairly easy to see and they're fairly easy to detect. When you have a line underground, you have a little bit more work to do because you have a little bit more inhospitable environment that's higher in moisture and is exposed to a little bit more underground conditions and that. But oftentimes you'll actually have to take the line out of service to go inspect it. As you can imagine, climbing down in a vault with a high voltage transmission line is not a job that you get very many people signing up to do, because there's a lot of danger involved in that. So oftentimes you have to take the line out of service. It's a more difficult environment to maintain a high voltage transmission line in.
I've spoken with several utilities. This morning I spoke with some people from Par Electric who've done some installations of these type of lines, and they're currently working on a project in Hayes, Kansas, where they're putting a 115 kV line underground for about a mile. And things that they said that they are running into is that, you know, like I mentioned before, that the maintenance on this type of line is different than what you need to expect from your maintenance of your distribution system. The types of, the one that they were putting in was literally an oil-encased line, so that the entire line was encased in an insulating oil. And then that was basically had to be maintained at a positive type of pressure throughout that line section. And so it would have an additional electric load associated with it as well, because you have a series of pumps and reservoirs that are needed to maintain that type of electrical insulation. Now, I think the type of line that we're proposing putting underground, or would propose to put underground, would be a solid dielectric that doesn't have to be encased in this insulating oil. However, we have no prior experience in this, so you know what, this would be a truly a first venture for us, is putting this type of line underground. And from some of the people that we've talked to, like I had said, you know, there are additional, you do have to get down and get in these vaults and measure. Unfortunately, you have to do it while the line's energized, because you can't see the problem while it's not. So you do have to send specially trained personnel down into a vault with an infrared camera to check your splices to make sure that they're still good.
Now, when these final proposals come to council, you're going to give us that cost. I'm assuming you're going to be going through over the next several months investigating the cost to these, so that we can look at the cost to put them underground as opposed to above ground. And when we're looking at some of these costs, I know some of the concerns, you know, you were describing how you took a string, and that's how we determined some of these routes. Was there any consideration for current easements? You know, there's a lot of people that are concerned with these lines going through, you know, dedicated space throughout their subdivisions that are, you know, set aside, you know, as part of our zoning requirements, and, you know, they're just in natural state. So there's a lot of things that people are very concerned about. That were any of those things taken into consideration when coming up with these lines, or are we kind of working backwards?
Well, I think one of the things you need to understand in the process is, when he said he drew the string, that's kind of how we started on what makes sense geographically to get from one place to the other. The one thing that hasn't been mentioned here is the evaluation matrix that's going to be put together. Well, as part of the comments and as part of this process, there's going to be a fairly extensive evaluation matrix that we take all these individual concerns into account and kind of give them weightings and averages, and we certainly expect people to have an input on what these matrices are going to look like when we evaluate the different line routes. And that's really where most of these type of issues that maybe have a political cost or an environmental cost or these type of things, these things are weighted in this matrix, and this is kind of how we assign a value to a route. And it takes a whole lot more information into account than what they used just to geographically draw the string on the map.
We're ahead of me, because that was going to be my next question, is, you know, will we be having some form of matrix, and how will that be divided for, you know,
yes,
established?
Absolutely. So that's very true, and there will definitely be input on this.
And about when in the process will you come up or propose that, and when can we have public input as well as council input?
I would imagine on the next work session we will have complete matrices for you to take a look at and talk about and evaluate, and we can bring those to you really as often as you need them. Certainly one of the things that we're doing from the public comment period that we're going through right now is really getting an idea of what factors need to be pulled into these matrices, and how do we evaluate them, how do we weigh them. And Sega might have a little bit more comment on how these matrices are put together.
I just have two more things really quick. You were talking about the Percy Creek line. I'm assuming that is the big pole that's right there at the intersection of Scott Boulevard and Chapel Hill. Is that correct? No.
That is a, if you want, can I go back to the map so it might be a little bit?
Thank you. I'm just trying to visualize where that Percy Creek, that short route goes.
Okay. The pole that you're talking about is part of the 69 kV line from Hinkson Creek to Perchy Creek. The Perchy Creek line actually comes pretty much directly right out of the Perchy Creek substation and heads due west.
Okay. And then we were kind of going over the generalized process and how that's going to play out over the next several months. Do you have any anticipated date of when the council will have the final, you know, decision to make? Will that be mid-year 2011?
Well,
I know, so it's hard.
I actually kind of penciled something together on some hopeful guidelines, and I think I had here a decision goal of somewhere around 2012.
So there's a whole other year.
Was where I was hoping to be able to identify and get started on some of the acquisitions for easements.
I think there's a concern within the community that there's nothing concrete that, you know, with the real estate market and things such as that, that there's, they can't, nobody can plan on when those decisions will be made, because for disclosure purposes and such. So you're thinking beginning 2012?
That was what I kind of penciled in, just using a conservative estimate on how long it would take for each step in the process that I see going through there. That's nothing I would be willing to put down in writing and say is only going to happen.
But it's always good to set goals and
yeah,
benchmarks.
And we're very sensitive to the fact that, you know, some people just want to know when it is so they can go make the decisions based upon that. I think it's very important for us, though, to go through this process in a very methodical fashion so we take into account all the factors that need to be taken into account.
I'm going to defer to other council members with some questions.
Council members?
I'm probably going to figure out a way to ask this without sounding like it's oversimplifying it, but how much of the dissatisfaction with the route identification can you attribute specifically to where we chose for this substation to go? For instance, if it was to go on the perimeter of the area of need, say along the Scott Boulevard corridor, would that have eliminated some of the route selections or the places where it went through, you know, where we're having the most concern through the subdivisions, through the neighborhoods? If this thing were to go, it seems to me the location we have is, you can't avoid a lot of the problems you have because you're starting in the middle. Would something along the perimeter have helped us avoid this issue?
Possibly, but again, we were trying to locate the load center nearest to where the load growth was anticipated to happen so that we would minimize the length of the distribution feeders, to minimize the impact, to basically to maximize the reliability and minimize the line losses.
But certainly, you know, certainly in our plan that we have now, the proposed substation is an endpoint. So that does play into the decision making factor. That's true.
While that map is up, go ahead. I want to ask a question with respect.
Okay. I was going to say, if we'd selected a site, say over by Scott Road, we would still have to found a way to get from Grindstone to that site, from McBain to that site, and Purchase to that site. So a lot of these routes would have been very similar to what you see on the map. Truly, there are some of the routes would be different because it's to a different site, but there'll be some commonality.
Well, it seems like, as I look at some of these alternative routes, you know, along the Scott Boulevard corridor is less intrusive. You know, it doesn't go directly through a neighborhood. And then as you look at some of the others along Route K, I'm not suggesting that's my favorite by any means, but you can avoid a lot of the just bisecting neighborhoods by going sort of around the perimeter and still using all one of the proposed routes for each of these. So it's just, obviously we own the site, so we have to consider it, but.
Well, I want to ask a question that may make the engineers groan. Most of our infrastructure is 69 kV. You're proposing to put 161 kV, which I think is one of the things that gets people's attention. Maybe this is a false distinction, but high voltage power lines in your front yard, in your backyard, you know, nobody wants that. I wouldn't want it. You wouldn't want it. Most of our infrastructure is 69 kV. Okay, it's still medium voltage, right? But this is from a non-engineering standpoint, would the public better accept a 69 kV loop? I mean, you could draw a redundant loop along from Grindstone along Nifong down to Scott up to Perchee Creek. You could draw a 69 kV loop and link it into the new substation. You've got another loop. You got a redundant loop. It's not high voltage. It doesn't sound like it costs as much money.
I guess I'm going to answer your question with a question is, do you think that the public would, and that's a very valid question, and do you think that the public would, and that would be something that we need to look at. If you think the public would truly be more accepted to having a 69 kV versus 161, we could definitely look at that opportunity.
Well, I live about a quarter mile from 161. But the feedback I'm getting implies that your point is we ought to find out, right? Now, now we get into the issue of we're getting out of the engineering solution, which I think we don't need to be locked into the engineering solution. And if we can come up with a less intrusive loop that impacts fewer homes, I guess another question would be, does it affect property values less? I don't know the answer to that, but high, medium, I mean, it's a question I'm asking, and I think we ought to address that. Is there a less obtrusive way to create a redundant loop?
Is the cost to bury 69 proportionate to the cost to bury 161?
At this point, we don't have any of our transmission or sub-transmission buried, so all of the data we've been gathering to date has been on 161. I don't have an answer on the cost. I'm assuming it would be less just because the actual insulation value would be less. However, if we're trying to carry the same amount of load, the conductor itself would have to be physically bigger, so I don't know what kind of offset there would be.
On one of your slides, when you were talking about the 69 system, is it that we would have to add the generation at Pershing Creek to make it?
I'll go back to that slide.
One thing I want to make sure you guys know is we don't have a problem with coming up with proposed solutions and taking things into account, but one of the things we are trying to get done here is we have an import issue that we have to deal with. We are a transmission-dependent utility, and all our energy that we get delivered from the sites that we own, the sites where it come in, from the transmission system. So it's, you know, we can certainly beef up areas through 69 as long as we still somehow, through some more acceptable manner, acquire more transmission.
And I would get our system somehow. I would throw as a corollary of the 69 kV redundant loop, I mean, you could still bring up 161 from McBain.
Absolutely. Right? And that's what I'm saying.
You could bring that up to the new substation, and then just run a 69 kV loop along Nifong to Scott and close the loop that way. I mean,
yeah, and that's what I'm saying. We would have no problem getting scenarios for you if we ran 69 for this portion, then we would somehow take the transmission import issue that we have and solve it this way. And we would not have any problem with it at all, coming up with some scenarios and making sure that we address the needs that need to be solved with the different solutions. So that's fine.
The 161 kV line and the 69 kV line that come down Parrish Road.
Yes, sir.
Are they on the same poles? They're all on the same pole?
Yes, sir.
So you don't know if that's 161 without knowing that? Okay. The substation south and east of Grindstone?
Yes.
What substation is that?
That's a Associated Electric substation.
But we don't own that?
We have a little bit of capacity out of that plant through an agreement, through that substation through an agreement, but we don't physically own anything there.
Could we run 161 from there to McBain?
Yeah.
There is a 161 line from McBain to Boone substation already.
There is.
I did not show Associated Electric facilities on this map. I only showed city-owned facilities due to some possible confidentiality things that we have signed between us and them. The only reason we label the McBain substation is because it's one of the points that we're trying to get to. But yes, there is a line from McBain to Boone substation.
So the problem is the feeders from McBain going to the new Mill Creek? The feeders are too long.
R-161 on the east side is well connected. I mean, that's a continuous line from north to south. It's the west side of our system that we have a 161 issue for imports that we have to solve.
The west side?
The west side of our system. That's where we need our source to be more redundant, because if we lose one line, we've lost import capability to that entire side of our 69 system.
So 161 goes to McBain from the substation I asked about?
Correct.
But it doesn't go to Pershing Creek?
It does not at this time, no.
Okay. Rebel Hill is a substation, but it's a transmission substation. It is not a sub-transmission station?
That is correct. We actually do direct transformation to distribution circuits there. So that is a load-serving substation. We just don't do the dual transformation at that point. Almost every other, I think that's our only substation in town that we bypass the 69 kV step. We go directly from 161 to 13 distribution circuits.
So the east side is powered by the 69 kV coming from the power plant and Grindstone?
Yeah. Bolstead, Blue Ridge, power plant, and Grindstone is the 69 line on our east side.
Okay.
And then we also kind of have a 161 line that somewhat parallels it.
What I'm trying to get to is it doesn't look any further on the map from those locations to the east side of town than it does from McBain to the south side of town. If that were a 69 kV substation at McBain.
Yeah, I do not believe that McBain has any 69, do you know? No.
Does it have the capability?
We would have to build it. It's not our substation. We own some capacity in that substation, and we could connect to it to get to the other side of our line, but it would be a problem for us to make capital investments in somebody else's substation.
Another question I have, any improvements will be paid for by electrical consumers throughout the city. We all know that. This map here shows the city limits. The Boone Electric Cooperative serves some of the area in our city limits. And it doesn't really show here where our transmission ends and Boone Electric meet. I just want to make sure that the people in North Columbia are not solving a power supply that Boone Electric should be solving, since they are providing some of the electrical capacity in South Columbia where our load is at risk.
Yeah, no, this is completely for City of Columbia's load. As a matter of fact, Boone Electric and City of Columbia is not connected from a distribution perspective. I'm not really sure how these issues grew up as time went by, but they've, I think, specifically made some differences between the systems that they just can't connect to each other directly. They're out of phase and at different voltage levels, so you would have to have some sort of equipment to even transfer energy from at a distribution level between our two utilities if you wanted to. And that does not exist.
Any other questions?
I want to go back to kind of what Gary was talking about. We're trying to bring a solution from the north, and if we can go down to McBain and build a plant down there and bring our solution from the south, it just looks so much shorter. If we're using part of that power down there, can we do an agreement with them down there and build their plant up, or we got fuel down there?
Build, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble. Build a plant at McBain?
A generation station down there. You're saying that to build a generation at Perchy, we have a fuel problem and permitting issues. Would it be easier to do that down in the McBain area?
I don't know it would be any easier. I don't know the capability of what fuel lines are down there. One thing I want to make sure that you guys understand when we talk about building generation, when you build generators in a location that they have to run for reliability purposes, common that you end up running them out of economic dispatch, which means that you're paying for the generator to run when it would be much cheaper to buy the energy somewhere else for reliability reasons to keep the lights on. Most of the time when they put generators on the grid and they permit them and they're deemed to be deliverable to the bulk electric system, they can be deliverable whenever they're economically the next viable resource. You need to be very careful when you schedule a generator that needs to be run from reliability purposes. You can get caught up in paying a lot of money for energy that's generated at above market cost or above what you should be paying for it because you have to run it for reliability. So that's just something that you got to make sure that you've researched before you put a generation station in for reliability only. Oftentimes, if you have very much cost that's going to be associated with running a plant out of economic dispatch, it would have been a lot, lot cheaper to put a transmission line in than the plant itself. But certainly, you could put a gas turbine. I mean, that's oftentimes they try to find a place to put a gas turbine where the transmission grid and the natural gas supply kind of cross each other, and that seems to be a good place to put a gas line. I know for our system, our big gas transmission lines are to the north of us, which is one of the reasons that we have them up at the Bolstead substation, is because there's just a few miles over to the tap on the natural gas transmission line. I'm not near as familiar with what goes south of town in the way of natural gas lines.
I have two more questions, one related to growth and the other to conservation. To what extent does this need to be done for the what we have now, the existing population, and to what extent is it to new growth that's estimated?
Certainly, with the loading we have right now, like Ryan had shown you on the screen, we have some issues with our current substation loading right now with, you know, that's really fairly close in front of us out there. Most of the issues that we're dealing with as they pertain to imports in our 69 ring are to address loading that we expect to come in the future. When we put our load projection charts together, we base them also as a system, but also geographically, which substations do we see them expect to show up at?
So I guess I'd like to be provided with that information in terms of the growth and load projections. I think that would be helpful, and where.
One of the things Tad doesn't want to talk about, but I will, is the question about what happens if you take one of these down. And the question is, all you need is a good ice storm on one of these lines, and you can lose a significant part of our existing load. Now, if you really wanted to do some damage, there are a number of places on here where a couple of insulators getting shot out could take down the vast majority of the city, because we don't have that reliability that we need now. So this is, yes, it's a growth issue, but Tad showed you the percentage loading on the major substations that we have in the south end, and they're already overloaded. So couple that with this reliability issue that we have. You know, it's not something that we should be dilly-dallying around trying to say, well, maybe we don't need it, because we do. I think what we would hope to convey over the next months is, in layman's terms, why it is we need this. And there are always some security issues. It's like you can't go into the water plant because the feds don't want people taking an opportunity to poison our water supply. Well, there are certain regulations as well about our electric system where you don't show where your weaknesses are because you don't want people to know that. Well, we got some weaknesses in this system, and we got to deal with them today. Right now, as long as everything works fine, you know, we'll continue to be able to provide power. I think the issues that we need as a community to look at is to balance the need for reliability, need for cost, and the need for environmental stewardship. And if we can find that right balance, I think we can begin to find a way to do this. So my point, and I get off my soapbox, is that this isn't really a growth issue. This is a reliability issue in my mind that will become also a growth issue in 5 to 10 years. And the longer we put it off trying to figure out how to solve it, the harder the solution is going to be 5, 10 years from now.
That's exactly why I brought up the idea of going further south with the 161 kV. I remember some years ago, more than I can remember, when the ring was built around Columbia by Par Electric, and it was a 69 kV line, and it circled the city, and we've grown beyond that. Now we need to put in my opinion, a 161 kV line around the city.
I think that's the engineering solution, and what we've got to do is, as the mayor aptly said, you know, we got to take that engineering solution and temper it by making a people solution. Tad, can you put up the map that shows the territory here, as well as the, there we go. So there are some areas that we will never be providing feeder circuits to, even as we see growth. If you look at the orange line, for instance, even if we annex south of State Farm, it's not our territory. We will not be serving that area. There are some other areas to the southwest that we can annex and or that we need to provide load and systems for right now, even if we don't annex it. And I think we need to judge the feeder system based upon the territory agreement at future build-out, not based on the city limits that they are today.
Well, the territory is fixed.
Pardon me?
Territory is fixed.
Yeah. I mean, yes, you could, if Boone Electric and the city were to agree to change it, there's a process to do that. So I would say it's very difficult. And basically what we'd be doing is swapping load. I don't think it would be in our best advantage to give up customers where we could essentially make revenues, nor are they going to as well.
One of my questions was going to be what effect the new high school and future development and then the other development that's likely going to happen at some point along the stadium corridor, what effect that would have. But if our service territory doesn't change, then that shouldn't have an effect then.
I think what you'll see is that all that's outside the city limits. So all right. That development in the northeast that the new high school might provoke has no impact on our electric loads under our current territory, even if we annex the area for the new high school. One more nuance to the final solution.
I would like to get a better handle on what it's going to cost to bury the 69 as well. I think we have an opportunity to, as this thing wanders through wherever it goes, I think we owe it to everybody to know what it'll cost if we're above ground for a while, where we can get it underground where it matters most. So I think it's probably important to get a better handle on that.
Yeah, one of the things I got from this was we need to be able to provide you guys with really a little bit more financial indication, both from burying 161 and from burying 69 lines in some of the proposed routes that we have out there. And I know that there's some cost associated with the transition from above ground to below ground, too, that we can get for you.
My second question, which is associated with cost, is long term, how long will this be a solution before we need additional redundancy, and how does cost for this long term compare with energy conservation? Is that a cheaper way to avoid future redundancy costs? I understand what we need now, but just looking at the long term, how does energy conservation play into reducing costs long term?
Well, I think we've seen some of the energy conservation applications and programs we put into effect had an effect already in the fact that it's pushed this out a little bit from probably where it might have originally been or had originally been forecasted, say, 10 years ago. I wish energy conservation programs would offset load growth, but they have not historically ever done that for us. We're still growing at a rate, and while it might be a little bit of a decreased rate, we still expect load growth, and so far our curves are showing that mirror what we've done in the past. On the future, obviously there's a little bit of crystal ball effect here in, how soon will this option run out. One of the things that's nice with the 161 kV fix is it truly is a lot longer term, where we can add, say, a substation close by the loop if it's needed as a load growth issue. But certainly the 161 solution is
a longer-term solution than if we put a 69 solution in, probably.
Do you know what this will do to the substation loading numbers, assuming this substation is built and the feeder lines are put in and it's up and going? What does that do to those?
We'll be able to reduce the loading on our existing substations when we need to. We can you know, transfer some load from existing lines onto this new substation and bring our substations back within that design specification of 50% for two transformers, 66% for the three transformers. And that's the level of reliability that we like to maintain, so that if we do have a problem and one of our transformers needs to be maintenance or for something goes wrong with it, that we're able to supply the rest of the load of that substations with the transformers that are currently installed there.
A couple other questions. We were talking a little bit ago about the timeline on deciding the preferred route. Can you give me what you see as the process after that? Which line do you think would need is the highest priority, whether it's the Mill Creek to McBain or Mill Creek to Pershing? This is a multiple year project between once we determine the line routes, then we're going to have to go through funding, easement acquisitions, and the likes. And we're probably looking at 3-4 years before maybe the first line is actually complete through that whole process. That fair estimate?
We get the biggest bang for our buck, if you will, from the McBain to Pershing, because that allows us to increase our import capability. So not only do we get the redundant feed into Pershing Creek, which increases the reliability of our 69 kV system, but we also increase the amount of electricity that we're able to import from outside of our system.
And then with the Mill Creek substation, this has been, I think, a question that's been brought up to me on a couple of occasions. Since it is in proximity to schools, what will be done at that substation to shield the commercial buildings that are right there within that proximity, as well as any schools?
We have proposed several different types of screening that may be available, anything from, you know, a simple chain link fence with screening inserted into it, all the way up to a very elaborate, brick-faced screening mechanism that would match the commercial area that's around it. So we'd be able to look at any of those options.
Not necessarily just from the visual proponent or aspect of it, but any concern for health, safety concerns. So was there anything other than the brick or the screen, fencing?
Well, the safety effects regarding, electric and magnetic fields greatly falls off as the distance you get from it. We've gone around and measured electric and magnetic fields onto our existing system, and we find that generally, on our current lines with the current loading, that usually within 50 feet, it's beyond even our equipment is no longer able to measure the electric and magnetic fields.
And I know that has been a concern since this process has come forward. I don't think it was really, I don't remember being discussed considerably at the time we were talking about the Mill Creek substation. I know it was an issue, but it's resurfaced again, so I want to get that out there so people can know.
Any other comments? I think you've made a very good case for a need to improve the reliability of the system. I think the public should know that the council is committed on taking this one step at a time and to keeping the public fully engaged in the process. We're a long way from drawing lines past people's houses. So this has been very helpful to me, and I'm sure to the rest of the council members. So, Mr. Johnson, thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.